Chapter 10. The port of Eilat came as a surprise to Asmira, whose experience of cities was limited to Marib and its sister town of Sirwa, 30 miles away across the fields. Crowded as they often were, especially on festival days, they maintained at all times a certain order. The priestesses wore their golden kirtles, the townsfolk their simple tunics of white and blue. If men from the hill tribes were present, their longer robes of red and brown made them easily identifiable from the guard posts. With the single cast of an eye, a guard could appraise a crowd and assess the dangers within. In Eilat, it was not so simple. Its streets were broad and the buildings never higher than 2 stories. To Asmira, used to the calm, cool shadows of Sheba's towers, this made the city oddly formless, a hot and sprawling mass of low, whitewashed walls that merged disconcertingly with the ceaseless tide of people that passed among them. Richly garbed Egyptians stalked along, amulets gleaming upon their breasts. Behind came slaves, carrying boxes, chests, and scowling imps in swinging cages. Wiry men of Punt, bright-eyed, diminutive, with sacks of resin teetering on their backs, wound their way past stalls where Kushite merchants offered silver gin guards and spirit charmers to the wary traveller. Black-eyed Babylonians argued with pale-skinned men over carts of strangely patterned pelts and skins. Asmira even spotted a group of fellow Shebans come north on the grueling frankincense trail. Up on the rooftops, silent things, wearing the shapes of cats and birds, watched the activity unfold. Asmira, standing at the gates, wrinkled her nose with distaste at the unregulated magic of the Magician King's domain. She bought spiced lentils from a kiosk set into the city wall, then plunged into the throng. Its turbid flow engulfed her. She was swallowed by the crowd. Even so, she knew she was being followed before she had walked 12 yards. Chancing to glance back, she noticed a thin man in a long pale robe detach himself from the wall where he had been leaning and move after her along the road. A little later, after 2 random changes of direction, she looked again and found him still in sight, dawdling along, staring at his feet, seemingly entranced by the clouds of dust he kicked up with every casual step. An agent of Solomon already? It seemed unlikely. She had done nothing to draw attention to herself. Unhurriedly, Asmira crossed the street under the white heat of the day and ducked beneath a bread seller's awning. She stood above the baskets in the hot shade, breathing in the scent of the piled loaves. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a pale flash move among the customers at the fish stall alongside. An old and wrinkled man sat hunched between the bread baskets, chewing toothlessly on his cart. Asmira purchased a thin wheat loaf from him, and then said, "Sir, I need to travel to Jerusalem as a matter of urgency. What is the quickest way?" The old man frowned. Her Arabic was strange to him and barely intelligible.
"By camel train."
"Where do the camels leave from?"
"From the market square, beside the fountains."
"I see. Where is the square?"
He pondered long, his jaw moving in slow, circular movements. At last he spoke,
"Beside the fountains."
Asmira's brow furrowed, her bottom lip protruded in vexation. She glanced back toward the fish stall.
"I'm from the south," she said. "I don't know the town. Is camel train really the quickest way? I thought perhaps..."
"Are you travelling alone?"
the old man said.
"Yes."
"Ah."
He opened his gummy mouth and emitted a brief chuckle. Asmira gazed at him.
"What?"
Bony shoulders shrugged.
"You're young, unless the shadows of your trawl don't conceal unpleasant surprises. Good-looking, too. Plus, you're travelling alone. In my experience, your chances of leaving Eilat safely, let alone reaching Jerusalem, are slim. Still, while you yet have life and money, you might as well spend freely. That's my philosophy. Why not buy another loaf?"
"No, thank you. I was asking about Jerusalem."
The old man stared at her appraisingly.
"The slavers here do very well," he mused. "I sometimes wish I'd gone into that trade."
He licked a finger, stretched out a hairy arm, and adjusted the display of flatbread in a nearby basket.
"Ways to get to Jerusalem. If you were a magician, you could fly there on a carpet. That's quicker than camels."
"I'm not a magician," Asmira said. She adjusted a leather bag across her shoulder. The old man grunted.
"That's lucky, because if you flew to Jerusalem on a carpet, he'd see you by way of the ring. Then you'd be taken by a demon and carried off and subjected to all sorts of horrors. Sure I can't interest you in a pretzel?"
Asmira cleared her throat. "I thought perhaps a chariot."
"Chariots up at Queen's," the bread seller said.
He laughed, his mouth gaping like a void.
"And magicians."
"I'm neither," Asmira said. She took up her bread and left. A moment later, a thin man wearing a pale robe pushed aside the customers of the fish stall and slipped out into the day. The beggar had been working his patch outside the bazaar since dawn, when the tide had brought new ships into Eilat's quays. As always, the merchants had heavy purses tied at their belts, which the beggar attempted to lighten in two complimentary ways. His roars and pleas and pitiful exhortations, together with the proud display of his withered stump, always awoke sufficient revulsion to earn some shekels from the crowd. Meanwhile, his imp, loitering among the bystanders, picked as many pockets as it could. The sun was hot and the business good, and the beggar was just thinking of departing to the wine shop, when he was approached by a thin man wearing a long, pale robe. The newcomer scuffled to a halt, staring at his feet.
"I found a mark," he said.
The beggar scowled.
"Toss a coin first, then tell. Got to keep up appearances, haven't we?"
He waited till the newcomer obliged.
"So, spit it out," he said. "What is he?"
"Not a he, a she," replied the thin man sourly. "Girl came in from the south this morning, travelling alone. Wants to go to Jerusalem. She's off haggling with the camel traders now."
"Got much, you think?"
the beggar said, squinting up from the corner where he sat. He waved his stick angrily.
"Move away from the sun, curse you. I'm lame, not blind."
"Not so lame either, from what I hear," the thin man said, stepping a few paces to the side. "Her clothes are nice enough, and she's got a sack with her that warrants a look too, but she'd fetch a good price herself, if you get my meaning."
"And she's on her own?"
The beggar stared off along the street. He scratched the stubble of his chin.
"Well, the caravans don't leave until tomorrow, that's a given, so she'll stay in town tonight, whether she wants to or not. There's no hurry, is there? Go and find Intef. If he's drunk, knock some sense into him. I'll go to the square, keep watch, see what's going on."
The beggar rocked back and forward twice, and by leaning on his stick, stood up with sudden, swift agility.
"Well, get off," he said savagely. "You'll find me in the square, or if she moves, wherever you hear my call."
He swung his stick and, with a series of limping jerks, set off along the road. Long after he was out of sight, his cries for alms could still be heard.
"I could sell you a camel, girl," the merchant said, "but it would be unusual practice. Send your father or your brother. I will drink tea with them and chew cart and make such arrangements as are meant to be made between men, and I will berate them politely for allowing you out alone. The streets here are not kind to girls, as they ought to know."
It was late afternoon, and the peach and orange light refracting through the fabric of the tent struck lazily upon the carpet and the cushions, and upon the merchant who sat among them. A pile of clay tablets, some old and hard, others still soft and only partially covered by the merchant's marks, rested at his side. Laid out carefully in front of him was a stylus, a tablet, a cup, and a jug of wine. A dangling gin guard hung from the roof above his head, twirling gently to the movements of the air. Asmira looked back at the closed flap of the tent. Business in the square was ebbing. One or two shadows moved swiftly past. None of them was familiar to her. None dawdled, head down, staring at its feet. Still, evening was coming. It would not do to be out alone much longer. Far off, she heard a beggar's whining call. She said, "You will make the arrangements with me."
The merchant's broad face did not alter. He looked down at his tablet and his hand strayed to the stylus.
"I'm busy, girl. Send your father."
As Mira gathered herself, forced her fury down. This was the third such meeting she had had that afternoon, and the shadows were growing long. She had 12 days before the attack on Marib, and the camel ride to Jerusalem would take 10.
"Sir," she said, "I have ample payment. You need only speak your price."
The merchant compressed his lips. After a moment he set down the stylus.
"Show me this payment."
"How much do you need?"
"Girl, I am expecting the gold traders in from Egypt in the next few days. They too will seek transport to Jerusalem and will buy as many camels as I can provide. From them I will get little pouches of gold dust, or perhaps small nuggets from the Nubian mines, so that my moustaches will curl with excitement, and I will close up my tent for a month and make merry in the street of sighs. What can you show me in the next 5 seconds that will make me give up one of my fine dark-eyed camels to you?"
The girl reached inside her riding cloak. When her hand reappeared, it had something the size of an apricot stone, glittering in the palm.
"It is a blue diamond from the Hadramaut," she said, "shaped and sanded into 50 facets. They say the Queen of Sheba wears one similar on her headdress. Provide me with a camel, and it's yours."
The merchant sat very still. Peach and orange light moved upon the surface of his face. He looked toward the closed tent flap from where the sound of the marketplace was muffled. The tip of his tongue ran between his lips. He said, "A man might wonder whether you had more such things." As Mira moved so that the front of her riding cloak fell open, she rested her fingers on the dagger hanging loosely at her belt.
"But to me," the merchant continued heartily, "such payment is more than adequate. We can make immediate arrangements."
As Mira nodded,
"I'm so glad. Give me my camel."
"She's going down Spice Street now," the thin man reported. "She's left the beast at the square. They're equipping it for tomorrow. Not sparing any expense, either. A canopy and everything. She's got money in that bag of hers."
As he spoke, he played with a long strip of cloth, twisting it between his hands.
"Spice Street's too busy," the beggar said.
"Ink Street?"
"Good enough. 4 of us should manage it."
It was true, what Asmira had told the bread-seller. She was not a magician, but that did not mean she was innocent of magic. When she was 9 years old, the senior guard-mother found her as she was practicing in the yard.
"Asmira, come with me."
They went to a quiet room above the training hall, where Asmira had never been. Inside were tables and cabinets of ancient cedar wood, their half-open doors revealing stacks of papyrus scrolls, clay tablets, and pottery shards notched with signs. On the center of the floor, 2 circles had been drawn, each containing a 5-pointed star. Asmira frowned and pulled a lock of hair back from her face.
"What's all this?"
The senior guardmother was 48 years old and had once been first guard of the queen. She had put down 3 tribal insurrections in the Hadramaut. She had a thin, white sword scar slashed across her wrinkled neck and another across her forehead, and was regarded with awe and veneration by the sisterhood. Even the queen herself was said to speak to her with some humility. She looked down at the scowling girl and said mildly,
"They tell me your training is going well."
Asmira was looking at a papyrus scroll laid out on the table. It was covered with an ornate and densely written script, except in the middle, where a sinister figure, half smoke, half skeleton, had been sketched with a few deft strokes. She shrugged. The guard mother said,
"I have seen you with the knives. I could not throw as well as you when I was your age, and nor could your mother."
The girl did not look at her nor change expression, but her bony little shoulders stiffened. She spoke as if she had not heard.
"What's all this magical stuff, anyway?"
"What do you think it is?"
"Ways of summoning demons of the air. I thought it was forbidden. Only priestesses are allowed to do it, the guardmothers say."
Her eyes blazed.
"Or were you all lying?"
In 3 years, the senior guardmother had had cause to beat the girl innumerable times for truancy, disobedience, and cheek. Now she only said, "Asmira, listen. I have two things to offer you. The one is knowledge, the other is this." She held out her hand. Between the fingers hung a silver necklace, on its end a pendant shaped like the sun. When the girl saw it, she gave a little gasp. "I do not need to tell you that it was your mother's," the senior guard mother said. "No, you may not have it yet. Listen to me now." She waited till the girl had raised her face, taut, hostile, tamping its emotion down. She said, "We did not lie to you. Magic is forbidden to everyone in Sheba but the priestesses of the temple. Only they may summon demons in the ordinary way, and it is right that this is so. Demons are wicked, deceitful things, dangerous to all. Think how volatile the hill tribes are. If every chieftain could raise a jinni whenever he argued with his neighbours, there would be a dozen wars a year and half the population dead. But in the hands of the priestesses, jinn can be put to better purpose. How do you think the reservoir here in Marib was built? Or the walls of the city, for that matter? Each year they help repair the towers and dredge the water channels, too." Asmira said, "I know this. They do the queen's work, just as the men must labour in the fields." The senior guard mother chuckled. "This is so. Jinn are, in fact, much like men. Provided you treat them sternly, and do not give them an inch of room to work you ill, they have several worthwhile uses. But here is the thing. Magic is useful to the guards also, and for one good reason. Our duty, the whole purpose of our being, is to protect our sovereign. We rely on our bodily skills for the most part, but sometimes that alone is not sufficient. If a demon attacked the queen..." "A silver blade would deal with it," the girl said shortly. "Sometimes, but not always. A guard needs other defences too. There are certain words, Asmira, certain magical wards and incantations which can temporarily rebuff a lesser demon's power." The senior guard mother lifted the necklace so that the sun pendant swung slowly, catching the light. "Spirits hate silver, just as you say, and charms like this give force to the uttered spell. I can teach you such things, if you wish. But to do so, we will have to summon demons to practice on." She gestured around at the cluttered room. "This is why we have special dispensation to learn such techniques here." "I'm not afraid of demons," the girl said. "Asmira, summoning spirits is perilous, and we are not magicians. We learn basic incantations so that we may test our wards. If we are hasty or careless, we will pay a dreadful price. Lesser guards do not need to understand these skills, and I will not force you to do so either. If you wish, you can leave this room now and never return." The girl was gazing at the little twirling sun. Its light flashed in her eyes like fire.
"My mother knew these skills?"
"She did."
Asmira held out her hand.
"Teach me, then. I will learn."
As she walked back to the inn where she was to spend the night, Asmira stared up between the darkened buildings of the glittering expanse of stars. As she watched, a light streaked in the heavens, flared briefly, and went out. A shooting star, or one of Solomon's demons spreading terror to other lands? Her jaw clenched, her nails dug into her palms. It was another 10 days before she would reach Jerusalem, and that was without the sandstorms that might delay the caravan. 10 days! And in 12 the ring would be turned and devastation brought upon Sheba. She closed her eyes and took a long breath in and out, as she had been taught to do when emotions threatened. Her training worked. She felt herself grow calm. When she opened her eyes, there was a man standing in the road in front of her. He held a long strip of cloth between his hands. Asmira halted, looking at him.
"Softly," the man said. "No struggling."
When he smiled, his teeth were very white. Asmira heard footfall on the road behind. Glancing over her shoulder, she saw three other men hastening close, one of them a cripple,
crutch wedged under his arm. She saw the ropes, the sack held ready, the knives tucked neatly in their waistbands, the glints of moisture in their smiling eyes and mouths. On the cripple's shoulder, a small black impling crouched, flexing its dirty yellow claws. Her hand moved toward her belt.
"Softly," the man with the cloth said again, "or I'll hurt you."
He took another step, then sighed, fell backward. Starlight glinted on the dagger blade protruding from the center of his eye. Before he hit the ground, Asmira had swiveled, ducked beneath a clutching hand, and pulled a knife from the waistband of the nearest man behind her, dancing aside from the stumbling assault of the third, who sought to loop a coil of wire about her head. She killed both men with rapid blows and turned to face the fourth. The cripple had halted a few yards distant, his face slack with blank surprise. Now he gave a long, low snarl and snapped his fingers. The impling beat its wings and launched itself at Asmira with a cry. Asmira waited till it was close, then touched her silver necklace, spoke a ward of force. The impling exploded in a ball of flame that spiraled away and burst against a wall in a shower of angry sparks. Before the fires faded, the cripple was away along the street, stick tapping frantically upon the stone. Asmira let the soiled knife fall to the ground. She turned and walked back to her bag, crouched, loosened its ties, and removed a second silver dagger. Flipping it in her fingers, she looked back along the road. The beggar was a long way off now, head down, rags flying, lolloping and bounding, swinging himself forward with great sweeps of his stick. In a few more steps he would be at a corner and out of sight. Asmira took careful aim. Shortly after dawn the following day, those emerging from their houses on the corner of Ink and Spice Streets made a gruesome discovery. Four bodies, sitting neatly against a wall, their seven legs stretched out side by side into the road. Each man had been a well-known slaver and vagrant of the district. Each had been killed with a single strike. At roughly the same moment, a camel train of 30 riders set out from Eilat's central square on the long journey to Jerusalem. Asmira was among them.